Welcome to your Digital Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Christine Boynette from the Wellcome Sanger Institute. In this week's episode, along with my guests, we'll be sharing tips on effective communication and presentation skills. And joining me are Dr. Claire Chua Preacher, a Wellcome Intermediate Fellow and Sanger International Fellow based at Mahidol Oxford Tropical Medicine Research Unit in Bangkok, Thailand. And second on my guest docket is Dr. Kate Baker, a senior lecturer at the University of Liverpool here in the UK. Hi, Claire and Kate. I'm so glad you're both here.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for having us, Christine.
Hello. Thanks for your invitation, Christine.
No, I'm so glad you can both come and join us. Both of you are my good friends, so everyone should know, the audience should know that this might be a bit more of a relaxed recording, but hey, let's go for it, hey? So let's kick off with you telling our audience a little bit more about yourselves, your journey, and how you got to where you are and what you do right now. So I'll kick off with Claire, if that's okay.
Yes, sure. I am Claire Chua-Preacher. I was born and raised in Bangkok, Thailand. English is not my first language, so I speak Tinglish rather than English. And it is always a big challenge for me to give a presentation, but we'll discuss about it later on. I am most fortunate to be awarded a series of scholarships and research fundings to support my scientific training in the UK, starting from my undergrad through PhD and postdoc at University of Cambridge. I then returned to Thailand to conduct a research on melioidosis, which is a neglected tropical infectious disease that is still a public health burden in many low and middle-income countries, and Thailand is the disease hotspot. Our research looked at the genetics factors in both the bacteria and the host that could influence melioidosis outcome, and this work has been funded by the Wellcome Trust. I believe I am a product of a great mentor system. I learn from wonderful colleagues, including Christine's and Kate, our today host. So I hope to pass it forward by sharing my experience through the Digital Mentor Podcast today.
That's so lovely. I really appreciate that. I mean, you both are much inspirations for me too. So really appreciate that. And I thank you for putting the mentorship plug into it for the podcast, because the key here with mentorship is really paying it forward. So thank you, Claire. Kate, tell us a bit more about yourself.
Yeah, I was good. I mean, it's hard to top that, really. And Claire, I just want to say, you said you were fortunate to receive a series of scholarships, but I think the words are incredibly deserving to have received those scholarships.
Absolutely.
So I trained as a vet originally in Australia and then worked for a couple of years over there. And then I similarly took a scholarship at the University of Cambridge to do a PhD that was funded by an infectious diseases consortium and then later the Wellcome Trust. And that was on viruses of bats and, very kind of ecological and disease dynamics. And then that was a lot of field and lab work, and then moved over to bacterial bioinformatics at the Sanger Institute, which is where I met the other two phenomenal people on the podcast today. And then after doing that, that postdoc got another Wellcome Fellowship and moved up to the University of Liverpool with that, and had a tenure track fellowship at the same time. And then, worked really hard for 5 years building my group, and then got confirmed in post as a senior lecturer a couple of years ago and continued our work there. And the work of my group is really integrating a lot of different methodologies, particularly microbial genomics, but also we now do quite a bit of lab work and work with math modelers to try and answer questions about the epidemiology of infectious disease as well as antimicrobial resistance. And yeah, similar to Claire, I think, having been in a few different environments, I think the strength of the mentoring you receive is really formative for your career in both directions. And, it's great to be able to pass on some of the experience that we've had.
No, that's awesome. And Kate, again, very accomplished. And thank you for that little plug on mentorship. I agree with both of your points. Again, just add, I celebrate these women very highly and clearly very accomplished women. And there's no happenstance here. They've worked really hard for where they've gotten to. So thanks again for letting our audience know. You can find more information about these guests always on the podcast. To kick off our discussion, I'll give you two quotes. The first is a Forbes article by Naira Vuleyman. She states, "Communication is considered effective when the message understood by the recipient is identical to the message understood by the sender." Right? And the second one is by Albert Einstein, which I think even adds on and makes it a bit more clear to what we're kind of talking about when we're saying effective communication or good presentation skills. The second quote is, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. And I think that is resonates with me both in, and I'm sure both of you are nodding, with technical and both non-technical audiences. What are your thoughts on those two? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Does it matter? What are your thoughts? Okay.
I definitely agree. Yeah, I that last point about if you can't say it simply, you don't understand it well enough is so true. I think, you know, knowing that we were going to talk about communication today, one of the things that I've reflected on was that I absolutely used to hate writing. During my PhD, I hated writing. I procrastinated. I dragged my feet. It was horrible. I didn't look forward to it. And then, you know, I actually received some training in it. And then in the end, I realized that one of the reasons I was procrastinating is that I often started writing when I had no idea what I wanted to say. And actually, it became really obvious to me over time that actually, if you try to communicate something before you know what you want to say, you can waste hours. And so it's really important for me that I do understand what it is that I'm trying to communicate before you develop those communication materials. You can do a lot of thinking, you can do drafting and whatever works for you. But actually, when it comes to producing a product for the people you're communicating to, don't try and do it until you've got a clear message in your head.
So essentially knowing what your message is right out of the gate, you'd be able to communicate it better. That's essentially what you're saying to people. Just know your message before you start writing anything, essentially, right?
Absolutely.
So write your last slide first, your conclusions. Is that what you're saying?
I guess just know what it is. I mean, there's a lot of process involved in that. Like, I wouldn't pretend that I sit down to a presentation knowing exactly what each slide is going to look like. But I think the most productive writing or presentations generating time that I have is when I have a clear idea of what I'm going to say. And it may be that I've done two dud presentations or smaller presentations internally, but when I'm generating that final, okay, this is the product for this piece of work, you know, in science, it's often a story that you're telling about a particular paper or whatever, then to me, unless I know what I'm trying to say, it will just take me forever and I'll just end up having to go back to square one. So once you know what you're going to say, actually, it's very easy to do. And if you're sitting and writing or trying to get something out and it's not coming, ask yourself if you really know what it is you're trying to get at.
That's cool. So you mentioned earlier that what's changed from when you began in your PhD journey and now. I'll ask you both now, can you cast your mind back to your first presentation? And however daunting and horrible it must feel like now, I can already feel the awkwardness that was your first presentation. And maybe walk our audience through how you presented then and then kind of how you've changed your presentation style to have more effective communication. I should add that these two people here with us in the podcast are really good communicators. You can see them online with different courses and different videos. They have effective communication skills, hence they're on the podcast. But yeah, cast your mind back to maybe what you did probably not very well at the beginning of your like presentation journey to now. I'll throw that to Claire first, and then I'll jump to you, Kate.
I remember that my first presentation during my PhD was very technical, intense, and it was driven by my worries that I didn't have enough depth of knowledge. So I spent a lot of preparation time digging deep into facts, looking into methodologies, and trying to perfect figures so I could have a mental safety net. However, the questions I got asked after the presentations only tap into a little bit of the technical knowledge and more about the concepts and the broad overview of the presentation. So I have learned that I should balance between delivering background informations, technical informations, and also nailed the take-home message. The scales of this balance depending on whose is the audience, though. And that's things that quite change between my first PhD presentation and now. But one thing that hasn't changed is the nerve. It's always more than 90% nervousness and anxiety. But I think these days I'm better at changing my nerve into enthusiasm and a big smile on my face for the audience. So that's the difference.
I love that, Claire. I'd say the same thing. I think it's turning your nervousness into enthusiasm. It's a real skill. And, you know, sometimes getting the balance right with coffee, I always say don't have too much coffee because your adrenaline is pumping anyway and too much coffee tips you over the edge. Kate, what are your tips for from your beginning journey to now?
I think the key thing for me, trying to distill it to one kind of sentiment, is that when I presented my first presentation from my PhD, it was for me, and now I present for the audience. And I think that's the key difference. So both content and format were entirely done for my convenience. So the content that I first presented was incredibly technical. I remember it was terrifying. It's a small workshop of 40 ecologists and disease ecologists, like literally bat ecologists who study the movements of bats. And I got up and gave this horrible talk about the details of redundant primer design without even explaining how PCR worked or what a fluorescent probe was. I had no concept of what these people understood and didn't understand. I didn't try and put my stuff in a broader context. The slides were like 70% text, of course, so I could just look up and read them off. You know, I wasn't presenting for them. I was presenting what made me feel comfortable and what I understood. And to be honest, I hadn't even thought who these people were or what they needed to know. I was just like, here is what I know, and I'm going to put that out there, instead of thinking, well, what do they know, and why are they here? What do they want to find out from me? And now, you know, I think first, who am I presenting to? Why am I presenting? What do they want to know? I virtually have no text at all on my slides now, which, yeah, I was going to raise the point of nerves. I don't know if you want me to stop there.
No, go for it. Go for the nerves. I think everyone has their own version of nerves, and please go for it.
One thing I found is that now that I do see presentations as that something that you prepare for the audience, and, you know, the content is driven by what do they want to see, what, how can I make them understand this, rather than how can I make my job of presenting easier, I prepare my talks more thoroughly in terms of I know what I'm going to say. I know what I'm going to try and get across. I know what that little symbol in the corner means. And, you know, it makes me less nervous because actually I've put a lot more work into getting those things ready. So I actually find that over time I've become less nervous because I guess I just feel more comfortable because I've thought a lot about what I'm going to say. You know, it's the same as the writing, actually. I know what I'm going to say before I walk in the room. And so actually I feel more comfortable trying to get the message across. I also sing as a hobby. So actually one of the things I tell myself before I give a talk that I'm nervous about is if I can sing La Bamba in front of 200 people, I'm pretty sure I can get up and give a talk.
That's amazing. That is cool. So I will say, and I think this then seamlessly gets us to you. And my next question for both of you is when you're presenting, so there's two schools of thought, think of nothing, rock up, do your slides and just go ad hoc. There's a few people that have a lot of skill and can deliver a seamless talk without kind of going over it. And then there's this second school of thought where you need to go over it a lot of times, but also deliver it so it doesn't seem rehearsed, but also as natural as possible. What are your schools of thought in terms of presenting and going over your slides and knowing what you want to say? Go, Claire.
I think I'm more of the latter because I cannot present ad hoc as such. First of all, when I think through the analysis, I tend to think in figures. So it's the Bayesian approach, iterative approach for me to translate those pictures or figures into words. So I need to walk my slide through that. And then I try to connect different slides together, trying to think of the way to walk the audience from point A to point B. So it's the iterative process for me to give a presentation. Plus, being non-native speaker, I need times to practice pronouncing difficult words. And in my field, this is Bucoduria sudomaliae, Bucoduria thailandensis, etc., etc. Otherwise, I'm stuck on this forever. And presenting numbers is another a weakness as well. When I see number, my instinct is to call that number in Thai. I need to translate that into English first. So it will be a huge challenge for me to present an ad hoc presentation.
That's amazing, Claire. And thank you for being your candor in telling us, you know, the challenges you have being a non-native English speaker. I do have one question, more of a comment. How do you make it seem so natural? I've worked with you for so long, and also we've recorded you in one of the courses, and it does not seem rehearsed. How did you manage to learn this skill so that even if you've gone over it a few times, you still deliver it really naturally? Like, it's almost like you've just delivered it ad hoc. Is there any tips you can give to somebody who's a non-native English speaker who's gone over it so many times, but still, have you done, like, I don't know, acting or anything? Is there any, or is just a skill you've...
I think it's not about acting, but think about the audience. When you rehearse to yourself, but now it's time to talk to the audience. So talking to the audience is the priority. But those rehearsals boost up your confidence. I think that's the way to put it.
That's a great tip, and look at your audience. And Kate, how about you? You have a slightly different style. How do you go about presenting? Do you rehearse, or are you on the other school of thought of just go for it?
So it's funny, this is something that's definitely changed for me. So originally when I started presenting, you know, as Claire says, you know, I think everyone's very nervous when they start presenting. I told myself that I didn't like over-rehearsing because it made me feel less nervous if I was having to think very hard about what I was saying. And actually what that meant was I was both very nervous, obviously very nervous, and terrible at presenting because I had verbal diarrhea. I didn't know what my message was. Again, I was just trying to get through that 10 minutes. You know, I didn't rehearse and it was bad, but I thought it was a coping strategy. But again, that's you thinking about you and what you need and not thinking about what you're trying to say to the audience and what their experience is. And then I had quite a severe postdoc supervisor, a postdoc who was involved in my supervision. And he said to me, Kate, I got a talk at a conference. And he was like, no, you should know your talk back to front. You have to know your talk, every word that you could say it without the slides in front of you. I want you rehearsing it in the shower. When you go to bed at night, you need to know every word of your presentation. And I thought, actually, I do get really nervous giving presentations. Maybe I'll give this a shot and I'll try what he's suggesting. And I did. And that first presentation, 10-minute presentation at a conference, like the first big one, I did. I learned it back to front. And actually, I was still horribly nervous getting up and talking, but only for the first minute. Because then after that, I did know what I was saying. And now I think what I do is I don't do quite that anymore. I'm in a really comfortable middle ground now where I have messages. So for me, this slide is these 3 points. And if I know the 3 points that I'm trying to get across, I've only got 3 things to remember when I'm up there, but I haven't over-rehearsed it. So I know that I can get my 3 points across and I can, depending on time, you know, fill in bits here and there and, you know, elaborate or, you know, now I'm at the point of presenting where I can actually keep track of time. You know, I can actually look at the clock and be like, oh, I've got time to add that detail. No, I don't. And I would never have been able to do that when we first started.
Yep. No, we're both putting our thumbs up, Claire and I, because we're saying, I think time is a really important factor in presenting. And if they give you 20 minutes, aim for 15. Because I always say, I think the mind tends to wander. Really long talks, unless you're very engaging or it has... I've seen very few people be able to carry a one-hour talk and engage, be fully engaged the full hour. So, you know, hence, you know, I really appreciate that people keep to time. Couple of things about like presenting and also style. So, and just give me your thoughts on certain things that maybe will help you keep time. So, because I've always liked slides that give me, it's slide 17 out of 20. So I also kind of place where I am. Secondly, what are your thoughts? These are just random things I'm saying, things that help keep to time, but also don't make you nervous. And this goes back full circle to what Kate and both of you have actually said is, it's word light, picture heavy. One, it also, for me, it helps me remember things as opposed to having lots of words and people reading it. I think that's I don't enjoy presentations like that because then I'm busy reading and not listening to what you're saying. And another one that I've thought, what do you think of stage presence? I'm just shouting out, saying things that I think are also useful. But what do you think of stage presence? Because I think sometimes it's easier to look at one person who's nodding furiously and don't focus on somebody sleeping. But what are your thoughts on any other tips you can throw in for the audience?
Can I just say one important thing? I think because there's loads of tips and I think maybe we'll go over some of them now. But I think one of the key things is that this stuff can be learned. Like I have quite a lot of tips, but actually I've been to quite a few presentation skills workshops. So I don't think you shouldn't assume that someone is a good presenter, like came out like that. And that was the first PhD presentation they gave. Like I've done a presentation workshop where I was filmed and then we went over it one-to-one afterwards. You know, I've been really fortunate to receive that training. And you know, I've been to another presentation skills workshop that was more about, yeah, how do you chunk up the presentation, like 3 parts, let the audience know where they are and you know, can elaborate on some of this. But I think that's the key thing is that actually if presenting and communicating is something that you feel is a block to you, you know, and this goes for anything, I guess, in a career, is like get training, seek it out, find out where it is, ask others what worked for them. If you know someone who you like as a communicator, say, you know, how did you get like this? And, you know, these are skills that can be taught as well.
I couldn't agree more with Kate. And I think a stage presence can have multiple styles. I'm in a school that celebrate all the varieties of style. I think you have to be authentic and be sincere when you communicate to the audience. One thing that I would like to raise is it can be different when you present in person and when you present digitally as well. For me, stage presence become harder when you have to present digitally through online platform because you interact less with the audience. Or sometimes you cannot see the audience at all. You have to make your own imaginary audience and assume that they still follow your discussions.
Oh, I completely agree with that. Also, because you're sitting down, I find presenting while sitting down is something we had to learn in the last year, whereas, you know.
Exactly.
What do you think? Go on, Kate.
I was going to say, I mean, one of the hardest things I've found about presenting over the digital period has been you can't read your audience because we all know that when you're presenting in that Zoom window, the gallery disappears and you don't see any nods, you don't see any confused looks. You've got no gauge whatsoever on if people are enjoying what you're doing, if they understand the last point you made, and it's really challenging. I mean, on stage presence, I agree with Claire that it's really hard to do digitally. But Claire, you've got such a lovely stage presence. I remember quite distinctly the first time I saw you talk, actually. And because, you know, you go to these training workshops and they say, be big, take up space, you know, have a deep voice, da 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 da, and all these things. And in many ways, you know, you're quite petite, you've got quite a soft voice. But actually, I remember you were like really, really engaging as a speaker because you move around from the podium and you're out there and you look people dead in the eye and you're so clear about what you're saying. And I think you were the first person I saw who'd used those. You had like a running bar along the top of your presentation.
That's exactly what I was saying. I love the running bar. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You flatter me so much.
I guess the point is that like, you know, you will be told these things like there's one way to do it, but actually there's not just one way to do it. You can be a really engaging speaker without all these silly machismo things that we're told about, like be big and reach your hands out wide and these kind of things. It's really about how you interact with the audience.
Thank you. To be honest, on that date, I had a sore throat, so I couldn't be big.
Oh dear.
That's why my voice was protected that way, because I had a bad sore throat. But you're right that I use a lot of physical movement during my presentation, and I found digital presentations so tough because I could only move my hands around a tiny frame, and usually that doesn't add on to my presentation either. So digital presentation is a new skill that I am learning. And also, I need to remind myself to look at the camera as well, because that way my eyes would look through the audience. But with the Zooms, I tend to look slightly downward so I can see your face. So now when I look at the camera, then I label my eyes right at you, the way you see me.
Claire's doing that now, just so you know, and it's really, really effective.
Especially I like doing that when there's no audience because I can't see anyone anyway, so I might as well look at the green light.
Yeah.
But I mean, naturally, we look at who we talk to, and now I look at you on the Zoom.
Are we going to talk about laser pointers? Because I think we should talk about laser pointers at some point.
Yes. Let's throw that laser pointers in, because I was gonna go in terms of like the hands and pointers, because I'm very emotive with my hands, because it's natural, I think, you know, coming from Kenya or whatever. It's just you speak with your hands as Italians do, or any other culture, actually, feel free. But so I do struggle digitally. But pointers, let's go into pointers and laser pointers. What are your thoughts? Because everyone has different ideas.
I'm afraid it's a no from me, Christine.
I'm with you. A thumbs up. I despise the laser pointer.
Yeah. I just think it takes the attention totally off the speaker and people no longer listen to what you're saying and they're looking at that dot. And there's no reason why you can't say, if you see that cluster of red dots on the lower right-hand side of the diagram, you don't need a pointer. And we've all been in that presentation, haven't we, where someone like holds it on, and then they just hold it on for the rest of the talk. And all you're doing, you're like a cat just watching that little laser dot on the screen, and you stopped listening a long time ago, and it's just horrible to watch.
I agree. I think I guess it's personal preference, but I also use the mouse if I really need to point at something and then to hyper focus it. But you could also use a zoom in or use another slide to zoom in on exactly your point. And then some of the time I get scared because I'm like, if they happen to keep the button pressed and they zoom to the audience, then you'll burn somebody's retina off.
Actually, I should say I use a lot of animation. Just as you said that, I realized that actually what I do quite a lot of for that, for emphasizing particular parts or whatever, is animation.
How about you, Claire? Are you up for the laser? Or also, I never have a laser. I love the people that got lasers as a gift. Do you use a laser pointer or?
No, not at all.
That was a simple answer.
No, yeah, I tried once, and then I had a hard time learning how to use a laser pointer. I gave up after the first three slides.
Also, yeah, it's really hard to keep it still. You know, it's I think that for me is part of the me as a user not using it, because I'm like, I want it to be straight. I might as well use a ruler, right? So another one that I found, and when I was, you know, presenting much earlier in my career, being interrupted. So even if you've said, oh, we'll wait for questions at the end, or maybe the chair has said questions at the end, there might be people who'd want to interrupt you, and you get better in time to be able to be interrupted. But what are your thoughts on being interrupted with a question, and then how do you pick back up to your presentation? Or do you just accept that there'll be a bit of ums and ahs before you continue? Or how do you handle being asked a question in between your presentation?
Again, it's something that I think if you've prepared your messaging and your flow, then actually it's not that big a deal, because you know, you kind of have an idea of where you stopped and where you're going. I have to say, I've not been interrupted to the point where someone was doing, like, it's never been something that hasn't been easily dealt with, if that makes sense, in that the people interrupting, the best thing is when they're asking you about something that's already in your presentation later. And you can just say, yes, that's a really good question, which is why I'm going to come to that. And you know, then it's really straightforward. Or sometimes it's just much more straightforward. I've never really had it where you've not been able to address it, or it's been something that's completely out of scope. And I think if it was, you know, you can always say, well, you know, let's come back to that at the end, or, you know, that comes up later or wherever. I think it's, you just need to pause, and then you need to, and give yourself a moment silence after to pick up where you left off. Don't feel like you need to jump straight back in a split second after answering their questions. You're okay to, I mean, you know, just say, oh, hang on, I need to think about where I was and get on with it. Yeah.
I actually okay with interruptions. I take it as a positive sign that people still follow my discussion. And sometimes it's good to clarify this point of concerns before we move on to the next slide. But sometimes interruptions, if it's not questions, it could be technical interruptions as well. And I've got a fire alarm as another type of interruptions during a presentation. In that case, you need to tell the audience to evacuate.
That's very responsible of you, Claire. I really like that. What if another one that I really like, and I've seen both of you handle fairly well, actually seasoned presenters know well, what if you don't know the answer to the question and it's to an audience you don't know, maybe at a conference? How do you handle that awkwardness?
You just have to be comfortable in terms of, I mean, this is just a rule for life and science in general, isn't it? It's like, you can't be expected to be anything other than what you are. You know, you've been invited to give a talk to this audience because they're presumably interested in what you have to say, and you know what you know. And I think just respond naturally and honestly. Just, you know, that's a really interesting question. I don't know. That's something I'd like to look at. You know, it's a really interesting point. It's not my area, but maybe something like this. Like, under no circumstances pretend to know something you don't know or fluff, because, you know, I think Claire's point about authenticity is, like, everyone sees when someone's trying to avoid a question, and you can tell when someone tries to BS, for sake of lack of a better word, when someone's trying to BS their way through an answer. Like, just be yourself.
Yeah.
For me, yeah, I think similar to Kate, I probably say I don't know. But before that, I probably smile first to working out what's going on in my head before deciding that I don't know. But usually I tend to welcome the questions that I don't know the answers, because that could lead to opportunities there's ways to explore the area that I haven't considered before. And I try to follow up with the questions with the person who asked after the meeting, after the conference, or exchange emails contact. It could lead to a fruitful collaboration.
That's an excellent point, yeah.
It's really true. This is like a very practical tip, but that's what the water is there for.
Yes.
Like if you are feeling really nervous, or you've noticed you're speaking too fast and you want to slow down, or you get a question and you just want a fraction of a second to think about it, to either find your place after a question or to pause to think about the answer, have a sip of water. You know, it's good for you to relax. No one notices, no one cares. Just give yourself a tiny bit of space, you know. It's a high stress situation and you need to give your brain time to catch up.
That's a really good point. Drink the water and have a break. Breathe in and breathe out.
Now every time someone sees me drink during a presentation, they'll be like, she doesn't know what she's doing.
Yeah, you set yourself up.
I've told you all my secret.
Yeah, I think likewise, now you even know when I smile, I don't have anything in my head.
Yeah, I think the drinking the water or smiling, it disarms people a little bit. And then just be like, that's a really good question. And I honestly don't have an answer for you right now, but I'd love to follow up with you. Let's have a discussion over tea or something. And I think just being really relaxed about it and being your genuine self, as you say, it's really obvious when you try and faff your way through an answer. It's really obvious. Just that's a really good point. So I wanted to move on slightly because you've both been recipients of really, really prestigious fellowships. And I think presenting to a sort of grant panel or fellowship panel, it requires convincing and influencing and telling them the story. Tell me how that presentation or that defense, for example, of your idea changes. Or does it change at all when you're presenting your work versus trying to convince people to give you a lot of money to do a lot of science?
Is the narrative that I would give in a grant the same as the narrative for the presentation?
Yeah.
Well, in a way, yes, but it also totally not. Because I think the questions you ask yourself at any time that you're writing, and this goes for like writing grants, writing papers, writing and writing presentations for me, is that I will never sit down and try to generate something until I know who it's going to and what they're going to use it for and what I want them to get out of it. You know, so for a grant, it's I'm writing it to convince them that I'm awesome and that this is a really good idea and that I can deliver. And it's going to go to two expert reviewers, then it's going to come back to this interview committee, then it's going to this and that. So, you know, I want to know exactly who's going to be reading it, what their expertise is. And the same goes for talks. So if I get invited to give a talk at a seminar series for a university, I'll be like, okay, who comes to these seminars? Because you don't want to get up and give a very detailed, you know, super genomics focused with a lot of technical detail talk to a bunch of undergraduates. You know, they need the brushstrokes. They need to be able to put it in their context. So until you know who your audience is and what you're trying to get out of it, then you can't generate a good product.
That's a really cool tip.
That's very nice. I need to write that down too. Okay, thank you.
Audience and purpose. I literally, my group have to do it before they give any talk. I'm like,
yeah, I think knowing the purpose of the talk is key. For grants committee, I ask myself a slightly different questions from when I present my result. I ask myself, what do they want and how my ideas can benefit them? And then I would humbly and sincerely present what I thought would help them either fill in the gaps that's currently missing or help strengthen the research in the field. So that's the approach for the grants committee or funding. But to present results, I think I ask completely different questions. I ask, how can the audience help me to improve the analysis? So I just present the presentations in the way that I want to get my answers. So by asking different questions, I think the structures of the talk, the presentations will be quite different. But for both type of talks, I think presenting with sincerity and be honest about the work that either you want to deliver or the outcome or the raw results, I think it's important. And the audience would receive that message.
that's such an important point, Claire, because I think your point about trying to get what you want out of the audience, because I think I did not realize until this year, you know, because COVID hit and we didn't get to go to conferences and present our stuff as much. And, you know, that's picking up now that the online conferencing's kicked in. But I almost didn't realize how much I got out of presenting those early results at conferences. It's like you say, you know, when someone asks that question that, you know, seems out of left field, but then as soon as they've said it, makes complete sense that it's a gap that you haven't addressed, or that it's a really important, or that your field, your work has relevance for another field, or, you know, you get so much out of people reflecting on your work with you. And you can craft your presentations to kind of invite that into the areas where you're particularly unsure.
A quick question then, have you both been able to present at a conference and you've gotten a collaboration out of it? Yes, are you both? Claire's nodding.
Yes, actually, yeah. Like, yeah, to the point where something very small, like a UK-based outbreak, turned into an international paper with, you know, yeah.
Fantastic. And the key to both of these two very good, effective communicators is, I would say that if you get no questions at the end, I think that's not a mark that you've covered everything. Usually it's a mark that you've hit, you've
yes.
aimed wrong. And you've missed something.
Or you've lost your audience.
Yeah. or the talk was too long and yeah, you did lose them at some point. That's actually really good. So what would you do, for example, are there any tips you would do for like take-home messages? I mean, I really like the idea of a take-home message because it wraps up and brings the audience back. And as I call it, it lands the plane. What other tips, major tips, would you say in terms of starting your... Because some people say, you know, you can start with the message at the beginning and then also wrap it up at the end so that you're saying to the audience, this is what I want to present to you today. Then you take them through the presentation and then sum it up. Are there any tips on structure of presentations that you can give to our audience?
So for me, I've started, and again, this is something that I learned at a training course. I didn't invent it, but to break a presentation into three. So it should have three parts and the audience should know exactly where they are in those three parts. And so, you know, that overview slide that you really just have as a bit of a, like, I'm meant to have an overview slide, like that for me is now like a real signposting of like, this is what I'm going to talk about, without really meaning to. I've also now embedded it. So at each point when we switch from section one to section two, you know, I have another slide saying, and now we're going to talk about this. Remember how I was going to tell you this is the flow. And it's really just about, you know, letting the audience know where they are.
Yes, I agree with Kate, and I suspect that we might attend the same course, actually.
I think that's the same for the three of us. I'm like, yes, well
yeah, but I think one thing I would like to add, particularly for speakers whose English is not a mother language, is that audience is your friend. They actually want to support you, they want to listen to you, and perhaps not being bold, speaking softly or speaking slightly different accents is not a disadvantage at all, because you can actually see that the audience try harder to listen to you. They really want to understand what you're saying. And that way, I think that you feel that it's very rewarding experience trying to present. So I think that's the goal already. So don't panic. Don't be scared. And treat audience as your friends.
Oh, that's an excellent tip for our audience and to gain confidence in presenting in whatever language you want to present in. And also one thing I really like, you know, WHO, they sometimes have great translators on. I mean, if there's enough funding for that, there would be translators in there. So hopefully one day there's people can present in their native language, and that would be great if we can all have paid translators. Right, guys, it's coming up to the end of like our discussion. And I want to just, if you can both have a think and say, what are your take home points to be able to effectively communicate what you're trying to say to the audience?
The main messages we covered really is know what you want to say, know who your audience are, and know why you're doing that communication, whatever it is, if it's a paper or a grant or a presentation, you know what you want to get out of it, know what they want to get out of it, and work towards that.
I think that's the fantastic wrap up from Kate already. Knowing the audience, be considerate with them, and then treat them as your friends.
Thank you. That's amazing. That's treat them as friends. And yeah, smile. I think that's another thing people don't realize. I think when somebody smiles in their presentation. It's actually really nice and warming as an audience member. It's like, oh, they're taking me with them. Yeah. And also as an audience member, I really appreciate nods. I don't know about you guys, but when somebody's nodding in the presentation, I'm like, they get it. Yeah. Yeah. So I like nods.
I'll keep that in mind next time.
You're welcome. Yes. Yeah, I think a smile goes a long way. But thanks again. A huge thank you to both Kate and Claire for coming on the podcast. We'll just go into wrap-ups, but can you please share with our listeners where they can reach you on social or where they can find more about you, any websites that you think are relevant?
Yeah, so I'm KS Bakes, which was my uni nickname, on Twitter and LinkedIn, Google Scholar, the rest.
Superb, Claire.
My Twitter handle is Shewaprisha, spelling C-H-E-W-A-P-R-W-E-C-H-A. I'm also on Google Scholar's LinkedIn.
Thank you both. And to our audience, you'll definitely find information of both of them and where you can reach them in the description box. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Please follow us on Twitter at @mentor_podcast. That's @mentor_podcast. Where we'll let you know when new episodes are released. You can listen to us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and SoundCloud by searching for your Digital Mentor Podcast. And apart from Twitter, you can also reach us by email now. So please send your comments and questions to inquiries at yourdigimentor.net. That's inquiries at yourdigimentor.net. As always, information on the episode and how to reach us will be in the description box, including how to connect with our guests and also links to more information and resources. And finally, like in season one, our goal is always for our podcast to be shared as a resource. So please remember to tell your friends and colleagues about us. Thanks again and see you in a couple weeks.
This episode is supported by Advanced Courses and Scientific Conferences, a program which develops and delivers training and conferences that span basic research, cutting-edge biomedicine, and application of genomics in healthcare. Through engaging and networking, the events educate, inspire, and transform careers worldwide.
This episode is also supported by the Wellcome Sanger Institute. It undertakes large-scale research that forms the foundations of knowledge in biology and medicine. It uses the power of genome sequencing to understand and harness the information in DNA. The Sanger's discoveries are used to improve health and to understand life on Earth.